We're also joined by Scott McKay, political analyst for the Publix Radio. Hi there, Scott.
Good morning, everybody.
Patrick Quinn, people who watch the State House in Rhode Island think this has been a pretty good year for the labor and organized labor movement. The continuing contracts bill, firefighter overtime bill, there's a bill to mediate the effects of the federal Janus decision. Yeah. How do you respond to people who say that organized labor has too much influence over Smith Hill?
You know, I think that's a narrative that the right likes to roll out. I mean, we're involved in campaigns. We run candidates. There's many people in the legislature that are in unions. People are familiar with unions. 17-18% of Rhode Island are in unions. We're not a special interest advocating for things like the minimum wage. That doesn't affect many of our members. It's starting to affect more because it's been increased, but we advocate for the general good, and we obviously advocate for our members, but I mean, you look at all the statistics, the places where labor is strong, schools are better, healthcare is better, you know, it's quality of life is better.
It sounds like you might be saying that labor as a Democratic constituency is doing a better job than constituencies of Republicans in terms of supporting Democratic candidates, supporting the Democratic cause. Is that why the Republican Party is struggling in Rhode Island?
I don't know. I'm reluctant to give the Republicans advice. I think the bottom line on it is that, you know, it's a very small state and you can affect elections if you run effective campaigns. You know, the threshold to run for office is very low and field is really cheap, and you can affect a lot of elections with, you know, 800, 300 votes. And that's what we do. We organize. We go and talk to people and say, you should vote for this because it's better for you.
Let's go to Scott.
I'm just wondering what your union has done to mitigate the effects of the Janus decision, which, of course, removed the dues checkoff from public employee unions if you want to opt out. Yeah. And I know that you've got a lot of employees, state employees over in Connecticut, for instance. What's been the response? Have you seen people opening the doors and the floodgates, they don't want to pay dues anymore, leaving, or have things been pretty stable?
That has not happened. But, you know, that's because our union always had a high level of engagement, but we increased our level of engagement and we reached out to people and we got them to recommit and understand, you know, what the value of the union is and what it brings to them, both in terms of political activity and on the shop floor.
We know that many Rhode Island municipalities have local pensions that are severely underfunded, and they also have crushing long-term obligations for employee health care. What role should employee unions or public unions play in trying to cut some of those obligations down or to improve the outlook for those burdens?
I think the original sin of this is that, you know, all of our private sector folks are covered under ERISA, which basically sets guidelines and forces you to immediately react. And that's not the case in the public sector.
So, and ERISA is?
Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. It's a landmark piece of legislation that makes sure that, you know, pensions are properly funded. We don't have an equivalent in the public sector, so sometimes people kick things down the road. I understand why they do that. I'm not here to judge them, but we can't keep doing that. We need to basically say, if we tell people we're going to make them secure in their retirement, then we need to follow through on that promise. I think what really makes the most sense is to areas where you can find economies, whether it's in the asset pool or whether it's in the administration, so that you can preserve whatever money there is for the benefits for the retiree.
I'm wondering, we're looking at the minimum wage. Rhode Island's falling behind Connecticut, which has just voted to gradually move up to $15 an hour. We're behind Massachusetts. The governor did put a minimum wage increase into the state budget, but the prospects don't look so good in the House right now. What's going to be labor's strategy for trying to push the minimum wage increase over the line in a legislative session that only has a week or two left?
I mean, my perspective has always been in conversations with decision makers on this thing is that significant portion of our population lives within driving distance to Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So if you don't stay competitive, because every conversation you have is like, what are they doing in Massachusetts on taxes? What are they doing on education taxes? Well, what are they doing on the minimum wage? So we have to pay attention to that for all those things, but not for minimum wage. I don't agree with that. I think the bottom line is if you have communities like Pawtucket, Bristol, you know, Newport, Tiverton, et cetera, those people will drive into Mass, they'll walk into Mass and make a couple of bucks more.
We're talking here with Patrick Quinn, Executive Vice President of SEIU Healthcare, 1199 Northeast. Patrick, your union represents almost 30,000 healthcare workers in Rhode Island and Connecticut. What are the top issues for your membership these days?
The major issue is that we want to make sure that in this transition from essentially getting paid per volume to getting paid for quality, that the voice of the caregiver is heard. We want quality outcomes for people. We want, you know, in this discussion that we're having with, you know, Care New England, Lifespan, and Brown, we want to make sure that we preserve what we have, which is we have some pretty high-quality services here, but we also need to understand that we need to pivot and focus more on population health, particularly minority health, and bring those outcomes to that population, manage disease, produce wellness, and not have as much heroic high-cost care down the road. And that's really important because everybody wants the hospital fully staffed when they get there, or their mother gets there, or their sister gets there, and they want to make sure that they get the care that they deserve. But the problem is, if you don't have a lot of volume going through there, it's hard to cover your costs. So how do we make that pivot in a way that doesn't cost people their livelihoods and doesn't compromise patient care?
Just a quick follow-up on that. We saw how Memorial Hospital closed a couple of years ago, in large part because its census was way down from what it had been years earlier. What's your explanation for that? Why did it go from a thriving hospital to one where the patient count was way down?
I don't get invited to all those meetings, so I don't really know exactly. But here's my perspective on it, and it comes from the wisdom of my barber. And his perspective was, better my feet hurt than my butt hurt. If you have no volume, it's hard to cover your fixed cost. If you have too much volume, it's hard to be safe and do the right thing by patients. So it's really important that we have an actual healthcare hospital, healthcare system strategy rather than let things just happen like it happened at Pawtucket. And that is something that this reconfiguration of these talks between the three parties might allow us to do.
Three parties, you mean Lifespan, Care New England, and Brown University.
Correct.
You know, every time you talk to the hospital executive side of this or the genius policy wonks, they point to something called the payer mix. And the look for Rhode Island down the road is not good. We have a lot of people, a lot of patients in this state. Lifespan is now at 75% in this category, who are on some sort of government programs, Medicaid, Medicare, maybe the Veterans Administration. And it's very difficult to make money and to be really good to your employees when you have all of those patients, so many patients linked to these government programs and not getting private commercial insurance. So what's the future for your employees at these large institutions?
Well, I think asking, you know, employers to pony up some money if they don't provide employer-based insurance is absolutely good policy because it at least stops people from dumping their coverage onto the public, you know, treasury. The second thing I think is that, you know, we need to move into a value-based system where we're not doing volume, trying to make everything up on volume. We have to move to a quality reimbursement system so we can do better there. You know, one other way to sort out this mess is to say, well, what actually happened? And we had about 7 years of zeros for hospital rates through the Medicaid program. And then we had a pretty hard cap. I think it was around 3% on commercial rates. Yes, they're nonprofits. Yes, they probably pay their executives too much. But we still need to make sure that they can get a rate of return that allows them to train the next generation of nurses, replace worn-out equipment, and build new facilities if they need them.
Who do you like as the person to take on Donald Trump?
I don't have a candidate yet, but whatever that candidate is, they got to pay attention to going out and talking to voters. That's why we lost the election. We won a majority of the votes. We lost three states by less than 100,000 votes. If we do our job and go talk to people and give them the reason to vote and give them a positive program, we'll win.
All right, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Great to be here.
And from SEIU Healthcare, 1199 Northeast, Patrick Quinn.
Thanks for having me.